At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Ron Burks is a colleague, a psychologist, and has a Master of Divinity, and he's a really nice guy. You heard the first part of his interview last week, and here is the second half. Here's Ron.
So can we then shift gears to your experience? Because I'd like to hear more about how you got involved in the church that kind of, I think, led you into this work, and what it was like at the beginning, how it changed, and how it affected you, and how you healed from it. So I guess you know the trajectory, but so sort of take us through your story.
Okay, yeah. Well, for me, it began in college, as it does for so many, because for the first time, you really are on your own. Mm-hmm. And you're also open to new ideas, and and the whole process of getting an education at a university is about, you know, having at least somewhat of an open mind.
Yeah.
And, because you're learning things you really didn't, you know, this isn't high school anymore.
Right.
And so I got involved with a very innocuous religious group that was very active, and they had activities that people did together, and there was a group of us that just happened to hit it off, and my sophomore year, four of us from the same group lived in this little house, right off campus, and it kind of became a gathering place for other people that that were really hungry for more than this particular group offered. So we were sort of we were primed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in the 70s, the charismatic renewal swept through the churches. And it's amazing especially in winter here in Tallahassee, how many traveling evangelists that we had who were from the north that just somehow felt led to come down and speak in these little prayer groups here in Florida. And it's just a lot warmer here than this,
right.
And then in the summer, of course, they'd all be gone, but it was some good times. And but gradually we moved further and further, into the the charismatic, area, and there became a lot. There was a lot of it was the beginning of the televangelists and some of their outrageous problems that they were having very publicly. That was happening many more times in a much lower level. And well, then along came these four teachers who talked about integrity. And they talked about that, we were going to restore integrity they had a covenant between themselves, mm-hmm. so that would be sure that they didn't fall prey to the same temptations that their other itinerant brethren did.
Okay.
It was very attractive. It really fit, our value system and that mine and my friends.
Sure.
So one by one, we all, began listening to their tapes. And there really wasn't anything to join at the time. There were just four teachers who would go to conferences and do things. And, I understood that they were going to put together a television ministry. They were, one of their administrators went to a conference on this new product called the video cassette. And the only groups of people there, besides, there were a few broadcasters, not a lot, but a few broadcasters. The only people that were there were religious groups, mm-hmm. and pornographers. So they formed this organization, Video Ministry. So they were going to form, you know, the lectures of these four itinerant preachers, and they were good. I mean, you know, they were funny. They were, you know, articulate. You know, very entertaining. You know, they could keep an audience transfixed for 90 minutes. You know, without a break. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just, you know, it was amazing. It was like, the only thing I can compared to, which was a, you know, an evening of a headliner comedian,
who
can just, you know, he's got you all, you know,
right,
doing a 2-hour, you know, show like that. It was like a show, and usually the music was put together by, you know, people from various churches in town, and it was often really, really quite amazing, just mm-hmm. like you were talking about in your synagogue, where it was just, right. you know, the music itself was, you know, and so by the time that, you know, the worship, you know, was period was over and the speaker began, we were all in, you know, we were feeling really good.
Right. Yeah.
And I went back when I wrote the book on my experiences, I went back and looked at my notes from those days, and I would see, you know, a Bible verse, and then I would see what they said, the Bible verse said.
Mm.
Well, mm-hmm. the time I was doing that, I was going to a mainstream seminary, and I was being taught, you know, the way that professionals interpret the Bible, and what I realized is that, you know, that isn't what this verse is saying. That's not the context of who, you know, that doesn't take into account who was there, what it might have meant to them, you know, mm-hmm. it missed the entire, you know, cultural, literary, you know, context that's always been part of interpreting the Bible.
Right.
You know, it felt good to hear that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't what that particular verse was saying. They picked up on one part of it and then tied it to another verse from some right. other author.
Right.
And
yeah. so interesting. And why do you think they did that? What was the purpose for that?
It wasn't unusual. A lot mm-hmm. of preachers yeah. preach that way, even though they know they shouldn't.
uh-huh. And so as part of you doing your research for your book, you were finding different interpretations.
And I realized the only way I could have not seen that was I realized I was in an altered state. I mean, I was, mm-hmm. Just like the research has shown, is that mm-hmm. it felt good, so it must be good.
Mm-hmm.
Because it certainly did feel good. And it, you know, the experience of these very articulate and, you know, and funny, I mean, just plain funny. You know, these were not Bob Mumford, for instance, was Billy Graham's favorite Bible teacher at one point.
Mm.
And so he was, you know, these were people that certainly did have a gift. Where their gifts didn't seem to lie was in organizing a worldwide movement.
Right. Okay.
And to come apart.
Okay, so Bob Mumford, was he one of the four that you
yes.
mentioned? Mm-hmm. Right. And so who were the others?
Charles Simpson, Eric Prince, you know, and Don Basham. And then for a while, there was a man named Ern Baxter. So
okay. All right. And the name of the movement?
Internally, we called it Covenant, you know, because most of the groups were called Gulf Coast Covenant Church, Covenant Church of Mobile. You know, and all whatever the town was, it would have the word covenant in it. And most people thought it was Evangelical Covenant Church, the old Swedish, you know, Reformed denomination. You know, mm-hmm. and would think that's what it sounded like, a mainstream church. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, they were all sort of under a multi-level marketing kind of system. So.
Ah, okay. So how did that play out? The multi-level marketing system within your church.
Well, the four leaders supposedly were submitted to each other, and then each of them had groups of leaders that, you know, that were their sort of disciples, you know, who had their groups of leaders, you know, who were their disciples, and then mm-hmm. pretty soon you started getting into the rank and file, you know.
Yeah.
And so a part-time or full-time pastor might have a dozen families or so that tithed. And so, they lived about the same socioeconomic status as the people that they were, you know, that they were pastoring, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And as time went on, you know, the system, you know, sounded good and had a lot of things going for it. But what qualified you for ministry was not necessarily your gifts for properly understanding, you know, the Bible. It was more, it was often, can you draw a crowd? Because if you could draw a crowd, you know, and they all tithed and gave 10% of their income, why, you know, you got yourself a little church group, you know. You know, and so, and that, you know, that pattern reproduced itself in, you know, in most major cities. About at any given, at the height, there were probably 50,000 people worldwide that were in this kind of system. Mm-hmm. And I'm sad to say this system exists today. And of course, you know, the shepherding movement didn't invent it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's evidence that people were doing the same things, misusing the same verses. In about 100 AD, 120 AD. So
yeah, it's been around a while.
Yeah. And it was, there's many instances far, behind that. Mm-hmm. So this is again nothing new, but it was became quite a phenomenon.
So. And so, you know, when you talk about having as your calling card that you can become a leader in the community if you can draw a crowd, of course, there are a lot of issues with that. There are a lot of inherent issues with that, because then it's kind of charisma over content.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Yeah. It early on, it became real clear that it was about appearances, not realities, mm-hmm. you know. And if you could put on a good show, if you had the appearance that you measured up to all the things, that was what was important. You know, there was called fruitfulness, you know, and, you know, and it was this emphasis on, you know, on being fruitful. And in fact, at one point we were in a very small group in central Colorado, which only has a 90-day growing season. Mm-hmm. So, and it's, I mean, between frost, mm-hmm. that's it, you know.
Right.
And, you know, so, and they grew corn, they grew all kinds of things there, but everything had to be custom tailored to that area. You know, certain, kinds of, you know, things wouldn't grow there. And, you know, and so there was that teaching was, you know, when you only have 90 days, you better be able to bear fruit quickly. And so there was a tremendous psychological burden if you couldn't bring people in, draw a crowd yourself, you know, because it was strictly became a performance basis. And, you know, and it wasn't the people who, you know, were the most actually gifted in the work itself. It was people who, you know, had the personality and mm-hmm. the ability to, you know, to put on a good show. The irony is that the group did produce to some extent, the very thing that it was, it set about to solve in the charismatic renewal, because you begin to have people rise up in leadership who didn't have the integrity, you know, that, you know, that right. they should have. Yeah. And then it came out afterwards that the leaders themselves really spent very little time actually being accountable to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the entire system held, eventually the rank and file were held so accountable that, you know, you really felt that you needed, I mean, people didn't tell you what to do, you know, but there were times where if you asked permission for something, or if you said, what do you think about, ran it by your pastor,
mm-hmm.
then if it went wrong, the pastor didn't get blamed, but you did the right thing because, you know, you obeyed your pastor as unto the Lord. And so because you are now doing the right thing, even if it didn't work out, you were looked on as being a good person. And and a lot of people in leadership, I mean, you know, once you're there, you think you really know. And mm-hmm. so people were giving mm-hmm. advice on who they should marry, but, you know, not requiring, so to speak. You know, but there are many stories out of what Christians call the Old Testament, where, you know, wives were chosen for their, you know, the young ones and so forth. So that was, mm-hmm. you know, so it seemed to fit that if one pastor suggested that person might want to date so and so, you know. And right. So there were a number of semi-arranged marriages that, you know, again, no one was forced to or expected to or required or anything like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, but there were people who, afterwards realized this is not who the partner I would have ended up with. You know, they may have made the best of it, but, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's like the Mooney weddings, right? That you know, Reverend Moon's just takes names out of a hat. Well,
that would be a caricature of what we were doing.
Right,
you
know, exactly.
We were doing and crank the volume up, you end up with
a... Right, exactly. Up to 11. But I do think that, you know, it's the same thing with a lot of different religions. It's the same thing with the ultra-Orthodox. In my religion, I, you know, that there are still within certain factions, arranged marriages. You can't make a decision without finding out what the rabbi thinks. And I'm sure it's a similar sort of thing, that whether it were the right advice or the wrong advice, what mattered is that you were being a dutiful person and you were doing right. things the right way within the community and for God mm-hmm. and as the, you know, mm-hmm. somehow that's more important, kind of form over function.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what is also important is what gets lost is cause and effect. What gets lost is if a person should be in a position to advise you if they really are not in a position to advise you. And sure. and if they should have the right to say these things. And I guess they feel that they do to a certain degree if there's no recourse, if there's no consequence, if they misguided you in some way.
Yeah. A professional religious leader is not going to practice outside their realm of expertise.
That's very important.
You know, they might have comments, something to say about, you know, finances, for instance, you know, but they're not a certified financial planner. So they may have some suggestions. They may have some things they found that they, you know, that work for them or something like that, but they're not going to tell you what you need to be doing is X, Y, or Z about, you know, should you buy the green car or the blue car, you know.
Right.
You know, not that anyone in our group was told to do that, you know, but the impression was that if I did what someone suggested, then it would show that I was obedient.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, it was much more subtle than a lot of groups are.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the subtlety was part of the problem. It was much harder to see, you know, because this is the same time where, you know, the Jonestown happened. And it was real easy to draw distinctions that, you know, well, we're not like them, you know.
Yeah, right.
You know, right. You know, and actually, you know, we're talking about addiction. That's one of the downfalls that most people have who are trying to get free of addiction is you keep comparing your experience with other people in an AA meeting or an NA meeting, and they've been to prison for 7 years, and you've just had 2 DUIs. And you think, well, I must not have a problem because I don't have their problem. And so because I don't have their problem, then I don't need to do this. Mm. And so, you know, we could say, well, our group doesn't do that, so we must not be a cult like they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, rather than identify, we compare.
Right.
If you go back and identify, then you could say, well, we did a little of this. We didn't do it to that extent. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of what was behind it. You know, mm-hmm. we did a little of that, you know, not to that extent. You see what I'm saying? You
yes.
know, it's
yes.
identify, not compare. And we were, you know, we were comparing, and that's what kept us from actually taking the, you know, the things that were happening and realizing, wait a minute, we have a starter set, you know, going on here. Now.
We have a starter kit, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so... what's also true is that, I mean, I think it's one of the red flags that if you're involved in something that says we're not a cult, like did we even ask, you know, but the other part is they usually craft a definition of a cult, right? That is on purpose, not what they do, whatever it is, right? And so every cultic group has a different way of defining what a cult is so that they can carve out their group from that definition. So you don't go based on their definition. You find out what a cult is. Reminding me of the story we were talking about that I told you could borrow, but when I did this group, right? for a church that's trying to figure out if, you know, mm-hmm. they had cultic tendencies. And I'll repeat the story that I had found a flyer that I had used at a conference years ago about how to define what a cult is and the different characteristics. And then someone came up to me after and said, I'm really disappointed because I really thought when we were going over your handouts that we'd really be able to learn about what a cult is when you were talking. But all you did was you made a list of all of the, you tailor made it to our group, of all the things that exist in our group and have happened in our group. And I said, no, I made this list about 10 years ago. That was a shock, you know, but yeah, to see it in black and white and say, oh, okay, based on sort of the general mm-hmm. definition, people who are religious experts, people who are psychological experts, you know, that mm-hmm. we fit within this, this now explains a lot. You know, this helps me see why I'm having these troubles and why mm-hmm. I'm having these feelings and feeling kind of handicapped in one way or another. I understand that was mm-hmm. kind of purposeful, you know, it really is very helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm curious about this sort of turning point. I'm always wondering when people start to notice, you know, and it's a very uncomfortable feeling, but it's also when you start to work towards having some freedom. So what did it for you when you started kind of seeing what I guess you really needed to see in order to make a more fully educated decision about what you were involved in?
Yeah, it was a very long process. And remember, there was no internet at the time. There was no place for, you know, for ex-members to tell their stories and to be of benefit to other people who were questioning. It was much easier to keep things, you know, under wraps.
Right.
And we had a, you know, negative experience in, at some point, the person who had been my personal pastor, he'd realized that he couldn't do it anymore. He didn't explain exactly why, but he just, you know, and he didn't leave the group per se, but he, you know, he stopped doing what he had been doing. So we had to find other places, and the place I found happened to be, you know, in Jacksonville Beach. It was a, you know, a group that was well known, you know, to the people in Mobile. They came over quite frequently. And so it was a similar group, and, you know, and he was actually one of the disciples, you could say, of the leader that I had, you know, the pastor that I had, you know, and so I was sort of put under him. And the, you know, there were good things about it, not so good things about it, you know, mm-hmm. and the person was a former Marine. So he understood, you know, authority very clearly.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So sure. Sometimes he would switch back and forth.
Interesting.
And, there were some things that were tough. And at some point we realized, you know, I told my former pastor and he invited me to come back to Mobile. So we moved back there. And at that point I realized this isn't right. You know, I just can't do this anymore. You know? Mm. So then we got back to Mobile and back in the swing of things you know, but all the while in the back of my mind, there was something isn't right here. This really should have been corrected a little bit, you know. I mean, the man was not abusive or, you know, it really was overboard from even what the group did, you know,
and
it would have benefited from some sort of a corrective action.
Right.
You know? But again, it's nothing compared to many of the terrible stories that you hear in many groups.
Right.
But it's one of the things that shouldn't happen. And, we got back to Mobile and, it was 10 years later before we actually left.
Wow. And, 10 years. Yeah, my goodness.
10 years of knowing something isn't right here.
Yeah.
You know, but yet we kept on going, you know?
Yeah.
And I find it astonishing that with working with my substance abuse patients that they know long before they actually are able to mm-hmm. stop that this isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had decided that this is not good for them sometimes 20 years before they were able to actually stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and mm-hmm. because there were so many good things about it that sort of smoothed over the hurt things, you know, and, yeah. you know, and gradually, of course, the group became more and more successful in that they started a subsidiary in Integrity's Hosanna Music, which ended up eventually being bought by Time Life. It was a big operation, much bigger financially than even the church was. And so all the finances started, as they got bigger, there was no disclosure. And then finally, when there was disclosure, the largest item, there were only about 10 or 15 items on this several hundred thousand dollar church budget, which was a lot for those days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, today that's perfectly normal for most mid-sized churches. But what wasn't normal was by far the largest item on the budget was miscellaneous.
Miscellaneous.
So,
love it.
So there was one of the dedicated members stood up in the congregational meeting and said, you know, I just want to say this doesn't seem to be very forthcoming, you know, and then the leader really publicly humiliated him. I just don't think you're being, you know, I mean, in a sweet way, you know, I think you're being, you know, I don't know what it was, but it was sort of, you know, being any hint that you were being disobedient was, you know, was a slap in the face. And that's what he got.
Sure.
You know, and most of us in the room fully agreed with him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but most of us were way too cowardly to be able to say, no, wait a minute.
Wow.
So that really was the beginning of the end. And of course, my wife had realized, you know, she had worked putting the church's school together and she saw some of the problems. And then they would come to decisions and all of a sudden the senior leadership would just say, nope, we're going to do it this way. You know, after the people who had been tasked to put it together, you know, had figured out a way they were going to do it.
Right,
and of course, the people in leadership were—they didn't know anything about how to start a school, and some of these people were teachers, you know, so they knew what they were doing.
Right.
She was beginning, you know, she was done. She was just hanging around because I was there, and then my mother came down with Alzheimer's, and so my father needed help taking care of her, I had to leave Mobile and left under good graces, but interestingly enough, hardly anyone, just one friend who was also not happy about a lot of areas in the group, showed up to help me move. This was a group that everybody did everything together. When someone new moved to town, there'd be 50 people show up to empty the truck. You know? And, the same way when people moved out, but by that stage, things were beginning to, you know, come apart.
Right. So. And I don't want to overlook what you were talking about with your wife with starting a school, because that happens within certain groups that start programs where it requires a certain expertise and insight and training, and then that all gets overruled. And it's very frustrating because then you don't get to share what you know and what you think is kind of best practice and what you think at the end of the day will be best for the children. But instead you're already roped in. So you kind of feel like you have to go along with what someone else says. And I could just imagine the conflict, especially with the next generations. You want to know that you're doing right by them. That would be very hard. It's like a doctor working with a patient and suddenly, you know, at the end, someone jumps in, you know, who does construction, you know?
Yes.
Sorry, cross everything off. You know, you can't take that medication. You need a hammer, you know?
Yeah. But I stayed at the Holiday Inn Express last night.
And so, I'm sure that's very, very hard. Very hard. Okay. Okay. So then the 10 years also, even though you can look back on it and say, wow, that was a long time. That's a pretty common thing. And I'm sure that you saw that in your work and you still see it, but you work at Wellspring where people had the impetus to leave or the insight, but it was still a long time in coming before they could make that change. And sometimes it's because of not wanting to leave the community or kind of buying into this notion that you were told that there's nothing else out there, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering then for the 10 years, what do you think in retrospect it was for you that had you hanging on for that length of time?
Well, it was getting back to old friends, and you know, that we had been very, very close to in the past, mm-hmm. and you know, and it was sort of being welcomed back, mm-hmm. you know, and this group provided instant friends, and I'm not talking about just one or two. I'm talking about, you know, 5, 6, 10 families mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. knew and saw on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And now, the longer the group went, the less, and you know, that, you know, of that there was, mm-hmm. you know, but that was kind of the, you know, but still it was something that hardly anyone can duplicate on the outside, mm-hmm. Of having that many people that you are, you know, bumping into, you know, talking to, and again, this is long before there was Facebook, mm-hmm. you know, you actually had to physically call them on the telephone or physically go to them and, right, you know, right, spend, right. you know, have coffee with them. And, you know, mm-hmm. that was what, you know, that was the, you know, the level of interaction. Yeah. And that was heady stuff. That was hard. And that's hard to maintain and develop or maintain on the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so then what helped you heal from your experience?
Well, for me, it was really going to seminary. At graduate school started my mind working again. It was all about critical thinking. You know, you can't take things for what's on the surface. You have to keep digging. You have to ask, you know, probing questions. And, you know, there's a lot of detective work in being a, you know, a theologian, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of these guys were excellent at that, just, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, their the processes they talk, you know, that they taught, you can see the same processes in the, mm-hmm. you know, and the, in the exchanges in the midrash, mm-hmm. you know, where you have one person that says this, on the other hand, you know, mm-hmm. he says, mm-hmm. on the other hand, you know, that was the basis of, you know, it was always questioning, always having to use your mind and, you know, and logic and, mm-hmm. and thinking through. And the more that I learned, that freed up my mind. It was very helpful for me. And it also was helpful for meeting other couples there, you know, who, because they were from their little Methodist church or, you know, or, you know, similar denomination, you know, got Wesleyan or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, we would, well, what was your church like, you know, mm-hmm. and we would tell them, and they looked at us like we had two heads.
Yeah.
Because we thought we were in an ordinary church, you know,
yeah.
just, we just with a little, you know, a little edge, but you know, mm-hmm. and that was very helpful. And actually it was helpful when they saw parallels from their experience in a mainstream church and yeah. realized, well, all you were doing was just this with the volume turned up.
Right.
And, you know, so that, all those interchanges, you know, having close relationships with people, you know, and, you know, classmates and, you know, and so forth, you know, was, so it really helped to make the transition out of, you know, the cult into a real world situation.
It's wonderful. It's really wonderful. I think as we finish up, I think that for people, anyone who's watching or listening, who either they themselves or they know someone who is in the process of leaving but might be too afraid to, or might believe that God will leave them or be unhappy with them should they leave, what would help to reassure people? What are good messages for them to try to hang on to empower themselves and not kind of believe that God only exists there, or that leaving doesn't mean going against God?
Well, people sometimes would come to Wellspring and they had to make the terrible choice. One of the first things they would say is that, I know coming here means I'm going to spend eternity in hell, but I can't live another minute in the group.
Oh.
They had made that existential choice that whatever, if there's hell to pay, I can't do this. You know, a lot of times it's a long time before you actually can let go of the mindset and the belief system of the group. You know, you just have to go. And so a lot of people, that's how they leave. We used to have terms called walkaways, people who got dissatisfied and left. And then there were castaways where the leader threw them out because they kept questioning. But then we had, you know, people who basically, they left knowing that you're still believing that the group was true, but they just couldn't live up to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you keep hearing that message over and over again with different church groups that are kind of controlling in their way or fundamentalist in their way, that here, you know, if God only exists here, and if you leave, you're leaving God. If people can meet each other and realize that that happens in so many different groups, and then it kind of breaks down the validity of the message, hopefully.
It just happened by random chance, but one time at Wellspring, we actually had the mother of God that we were treating, and we had the wife of God. And of course, they didn't know each other.
Uh-huh. But they didn't know each other. Yeah, well, you know, mothers-in-law, you know how.
Now, they both came, and the group that the older woman was in, she had come to believe that, yes, that her son was God, you know, incarnate, you know, and that's what he taught, and that's, you know, and they had a following, and she was, had a revered position as the mother of God, you know, and, you know, and after a while, of course, you know, she walked away, but it was still very, she still had a lot of work, knew she had a lot of work to do, so why she came to Wellspring. But then what really was so therapeutic was to meet this young woman who had left, had divorced her husband, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, not long after they had gotten married, he began to, you know, have these experiences, and then he would tell people about them, and it attracted people to them until people finally began to acknowledge what he was beginning to suggest was that he was God. And so they had this mock argument one time that said, you know, the first name of what the son, first name of the, you know, the husband was, you know, no, he's God. No, he's God. No. So that really was therapeutic, probably more therapeutic than any of the interventions we had, was just to be able to finally break free and laugh about the, you know, the craziness of the situation. And it helped break them out of their, you know, their funk.
You know, years ago when the Cult Awareness Network was the Cult Awareness Network, not a part of Scientology. This still blows my mind. There were groups for people who had left different kinds of cultic groups. And so there was a group of people who had left Bible-based cults, and somebody had little buttons printed for the group that he was a part of too at the conference. And they said, my God can beat up your God.
And, yeah.
Just to kind of show, like, you know, I got better, because that's what we were told, you know, and just to kind of, you know, kind of use some humor also, but to point out, yes, all of this, it can get a little nutty.
We had one person bring a t-shirt to Wellspring, you know, and it had a picture, you know, and figure of Jesus. And the line under it was, "Dear Jesus, please protect me from your followers."
Yeah. You know, there was recently something about how an article about Jewish hipsters, and they're big, you know, there's a big group of Jewish hipsters. And in my mind, I pictured Jesus as a Jewish hipster. I don't know why. Like, just. You know, a teacher, a dude, someone who, you know, it's like, you know, whatever. So, but the, yes, that's not how he's viewed in other circles. But still, I think also just to highlight that for some people, they leave and want to find themselves something that is a spiritual community, are very fearful of it, but still sure. want that. And mm-hmm. then other people kind of go to another, the pendulum swings, and they don't want any of it, and they don't want to believe in anything. It was too damaging or too hurtful. Mm-hmm. And they go towards atheism, whatever it is, or, you know, being mm-hmm. agnostic. I don't care either way. I mean, I think, though, what is important for people is to not spend the rest of your life making a decision that is still in reaction to
yes.
your experience,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It should be based really on finding the thing that you think gives your life that kind of right answer or that meaning, whether it is not believing in God and believing in right. sort of godliness or humanity mm-hmm. or just, you know, how we treat each other and treat our world and the earth, or a belief in God, but that it becomes something that comes from you and you can take action rather than still reacting.
Right.
So how would you help someone with that, kind of just be able to really block out the noise, right? And just take that kind of, take those steps for them.
Well, I'm amazed when I see people who've been from such abusive groups that find their way, you know, even people who grew up in a group that do find their way to some sort of a belief system that makes sense for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the courage that it takes to do that is quite phenomenal. We do use the term, it's called practicing safe sects.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
You know, there are certain characteristics of any body, any group, whether it's religious or, you know, or meditative or whatever that is, you know, that fits where you are at the time. There are certain characteristics to look for that are suggestive that probably, you know, this is a, you know, this is a group that is not going to, you know, or is not harmful. And probably won't develop it, you know, for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's, you know, one of the things that can be helpful, for instance, is, you know, being part of a group that, you know, has been around for more than 200 years and all its founders are dead. You know, and usually it's going to be a group that's going to cooperate with lots of other like-minded groups on humanitarian causes, even if the groups they cooperate with don't fit the same, don't have exactly the same belief system, but they probably share elements of their value system, and that's where they work together.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot, you know, you can see, tell a lot about the health of a group when they're, it's like one family friend was talking about a group that he thought was just another church in town, and they were trying to work with them, and he was saying very nicely, he said, "This group is radically uncooperative."
Ooh, and okay.
Later, I found out that was an International Church of Christ. That, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, done anything with any other church. You know, he thought it was a mainstream Church of Christ, and most of them worked with, you know, with their church to, you know, on different things.
Mm-hmm. You know,
but, that was in the old days of ICOC. So
right, yeah, no, International Church of Christ. I mean, it's been around for a long time, and yeah, people do confuse it with mainline Churches of Christ. It's really a shame. It's nothing like it. So to when you enter a place and they say, "Do you want to join?" and you say, "I'm not sure. Are your founders still living?" Just clarify that first.
Sometimes you don't have to ask questions about that, but expect good groups of people to be outgoing and to be, you know, to be kind, but not pushy. You know, and they, you know, they may be used to a level of comfort in relationships that you are no longer comfortable with, and that's okay. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a problem. It does mean that, you know, to let your radar tell you, but don't let it run you off right away. The reason that I say mainstream groups is because quite often mainstream groups require a certain psychological and training and other kinds of training in their, you know, in whatever it is they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so chances are the leaders are more going to be more professional than in a church that was just started by an articulate, you know, person who, you know, either read the Bible a lot or they had a guru that, you know, and now they've left them and they're starting off on their own.
Also, I think with a mainstream group, you have safeguards. You have a board or a body that you can go talk to, right? A place that's going to be neutral, hopefully. It'll be safe, and you can say that something bad has happened to you or get a response that's not about turning it back on you, which I think is really very important. It's like people who meet with any kind of unlicensed or unregulated anybody. There are no safeguards. There's no system of checks and balances. You have no recourse, no protection. Okay. Okay. And so any other characteristics just to watch out for? Maybe one or two more before we...
You're going to have a leader that the focus is not so much on him. You know, now there's certain large mainstream churches where the pastor is a local celebrity. And, you know, there's sometimes the term is pastor of ceremonies, and to be asked to give the convocation at a high school football game or something like that, things like that. But generally that's not the focus. You know, the focus is not on the leader. The leader is someone who has a role to play, you know, a particular job, and they do that. And, the daily affairs of the organization have to do with the volunteers that are part of it. And you feel like you are contributing. People feel like they're a contributing part, and and not necessarily being told, you know, that doing what they're being told to do. You know, they're using their expertise to do. You know, and so a lot of times you'll see a big church. If it's a large church, it will have things that are obviously started because if somebody had a good idea. There's a big church that has a group called PAWS. Pets are witnesses too, and so they did animal therapy in hospitals, and in prisons and things like that. You know, so you'll see, you know, outreaches that were started by people in the community, not someone that came down from the top. You know, things like that. You know, just someone who just on a lark one time went to Panera Bread and, you know, because he heard they were throwing away, you know, bread every time. So he'd go to Panera Bread and then he would pick up, you know, on Friday nights, you know, when they throw all their bread away, you know, and then he would take it to the, you know, to the food bank and it would be available the next day. You know? And I mean, it was just somebody who, you know, took it upon themselves to do that. And it,
you know. Right. And I think then you get reminded that you're part of a larger world that, right, you're focus is outside the walls as well of the church, and that the leader will let your focus be outside the walls.
Yes, and you'll get the impression that you're expected to bring your brain and your skills. Your individual skills will be appreciated, not you know, told to be subsumed under some other mindset that should be, you know, what you're doing is godly enough or something.
Right. Or just how devoted you are to, or self-sacrificial you are to the leader and to the church. Right. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Ron, it's so nice to talk to you. It's fun.
It's been great, Rachel.
And I hope we can do it again. I know that you have had so many years of experience that there's so much to share. Can you mention the name of your book again as we finish up, and then also let people know where they can find you if they want to consult with you or just find out about the work that you're doing?
The name of the book is Damaged Disciples, and you can still get used copies of it on Amazon. It's I think it's 1,436,000 in it as far as ranking of sales in any given month. So. So there are only a few hundred copies out in circulation these days, but they keeps coming back up for sale. So usually you can find one. If there's not, there'll be some there.
Okay. And then any other website or email help if people want your help or your insight?
My website is very simple at this point, and it's ronburksphd.com. You know, and my email is ron@ronburksphd.com. That's probably the best way to get in touch with me. You can also, if you need to call and talk, call my office at the hospital. The hospital that I work for is a non-for-profit hospital. It's the, you know, we call it the, you know, this is St. Elsewhere, you know, we're the place where they bring the, you know, the hard cases, that kind of stuff, you know. So, but the idea is they're very interested in what I'm doing, and they give me time, to field people's phone calls. But that's a number, you know, area code 850-431, and then it spells out the word fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's an inside joke in the recovery community. It's a bit off color, but I mean, help and hope is already taken. So,
okay.
And I can also, you know, I'm available to do consults you know, in these issues, you know, to help supplement counseling that the person might have, you know, you know, in the home area with someone who doesn't necessarily understand cults. So we can fill in the blanks there.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ron. It's a pleasure, and my regards to Vicki, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
One more thing before you go. So there was so much that was interesting about the second part of Ron's conversation with me. But I wanted to go back to something he was saying about when he was working at Wellspring, that in attendance, there was at one point the Mother of God and the Sister of God. And ironically, they hadn't met each other before. So this is something that I sometimes come across in my work, which makes my work even more interesting than it already is. It's hard to know why people start to believe they are God. Sometimes it is a brain disorder and delusional thinking, sometimes overblown grandiosity. Whatever the driving force and origin of it, it happens. And I find it so interesting that if someone thinks he or she is God, there is usually a spouse, a parent, a child, or sibling who is impacted by that, no question. I've seen it happen a lot, and I've met people like Ron has. I've met the Mother of God before, and I met the Brother of God, and also some of the kids of God, and the wife of God. Just recently, I met the grandchildren of God, so I've met a lot of God's family. The typical reaction I see from family members is genuine concern and an understandable hesitancy in telling me why they've contacted me. How do you start things off? Hi, Rachel. So it seems that I'm married to God. And so do you have any questions for me so far? No, I'm good. I'm getting used to that as a conversation starter. I don't mean to make fun. It's just a startling moment for the listener. And then I suddenly feel a wave of compassion, knowing the gravity of this situation and sometimes the long road ahead for the loved ones. There are some famous stories about people like the sons of Jim Jones who were not on the compound during the massacre. The day they lost family members, including both their father and their mother, they carry with them the burden of having had a father who rose in his followers' eyes and in his own eyes to the position of the Messiah. And many of you have heard my interview with Jamie DeWolf and the additional one with him for Patreon subscribers. Definitely check it out. Jamie is the great-grandson of L. Ron Hubbard, the godlike, all-knowing, all-powerful founder of Scientology. But there are lesser known stories like the following. I have a client, a woman who was raised on a farm by, as she said, the Messiah, who also happened to be her dad. He had many wives, many, many children, and others who were swept up into his charismatic and spiritual vortex. She was held to a higher standard than anyone else, and as the firstborn child of the Messiah, it was really not until she left the farm, when she was told to actually to go out into the community to recruit others when she was old enough, that she saw how different her life was than anyone else's she came across. This started her on the path out. She saw a freedom she'd never known. She actually observed interactions between parents and children that were kind and gentle and respectful. And she was also baffled by something that most of us take for granted. When she greeted people, as she was trained to by asking people first how they were, before telling them about the idyllic farm that they should want to go to, the people would often respond to her question by asking her in return, "How are you?" It was in these moments that she realized she hadn't ever been asked how she was before, and she didn't know how to answer it. But it made her realize that it was only in her family on the farm that it didn't matter. it didn't matter that she was unhappy or that she was troubled by something. It didn't matter what she was thinking. But the questions came so easily from others, and they actually waited for a response because it mattered. This was life-changing to her, and when she went back to the farm at the end of her recruiting days, she felt how she had only mattered there because of her work for the group, because her perfect behavior was used as a way to make her father look good, and for a lot of other reasons, but not just because she was a living, breathing human being with feelings. She left 2 years later. Her mother left a few months after, and they now live together and are healing together. And then there was another situation I wanted to let you know about. I got a call from a woman who said she was trying to be a better mother-in-law to her daughter-in-law, and they were all living together, but it was hard to obey her all the time. Obey? I asked. Yes, obey. She is the daughter of our pastor who passed away, and she was next in line, and she became the messenger of God's word. This woman's son married this woman, and they moved into a house all together with the mother-in-law, who was the one who called me. The difference with this situation was that the woman who called me, having been raised in the group, did truly believe that the spiritual baton had been passed from the leader to her daughter-in-law, and that disagreeing with her would be the same as arguing with God. And she wanted my help to learn to become more accepting and deferential to a woman who was half her age, who was cold and demanding, strict, and at times highly abusive and insulting and patronizing. This daughter-in-law didn't follow in her father's, "I am the humble servant of God's footsteps," but rather seemed to love the power. And its power she never worked for, but just inherited. It reminds me of a quote from the writer Suzanne Necker, who said, "Fortune does not change men, it unmasks them. So does power." My challenge was to help my client know she had the right to be treated respectfully in her own home by her daughter-in-law, and to also have her son step in and help her out. But I wasn't able to succeed at that time. The ingrained and long-term programming and the absolute belief that the power and word of God had been passed down from father to daughter was just too great to challenge, too scary to challenge. And my client was just too afraid to stand up to her, because what if it was true? She didn't want God to be upset with her. Fear is fear. This daughter-in-law, though, recently had a daughter of her own, making my client a grandmother. And then my client called me saying that she was caring for her granddaughter daily while her daughter-in-law did work for the church, but that in her interactions with her teeny granddaughter, she didn't feel the same fear with her or the sense that the baton had been passed down once again. And it freed her a bit. And she wanted to know if this was her chance to not only start to break free of the fear, but also maybe use some of the time with her granddaughter to help her grow up more empowered and less afraid than my client was able to grow up. And then they could grow strong together. It was a beautiful ending to the story. Actually, it's more like a beautiful beginning. Talk to you next week. As this podcast has started its second year, which is so exciting, I want to be able to reach out to you and speak to you seriously about helping to become subscribers and helping to sustain it. It is very uncomfortable for me to ask for money, really for anything, but especially for this. I know many people who listen to this benefit from it and can only benefit from it because it is free to listen to. But for others who are able to help sustain it, I would so appreciate you doing it. In fact, it's necessary. It's necessary to keep it going. So go to patreon.com/indoctrination. If you can't find the link, email me at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. Just let me know that you would like to become a supporter of the show. I really want it to continue, and so many of the people who get in contact with me who see it as so valuable and kind of a watershed moment for them to help them grow and change and move and see that what they're involved in is not healthy and they develop the strength to leave. I don't want this show to end for them and for everyone else. So I do my best with what I have to try to keep the show going, but I really can't keep doing it almost all on my own. It will be too hard and I won't be able to sustain it. So please, please, if it has helped you, if you think the stories are interesting, if you feel that they are heartwarming, if you think they are really, really powerful, and also in a very tangible way, offering opportunities for people to know how to live their lives and how to be free and how to prevent themselves from getting in these situations, then please support the show. If it is important to you in some personal way, or if you just like listening to it because the stories are interesting, I so appreciate it. All of the listeners appreciate it. And please do what you can. Keep it going. Thank you.
Indoctrination is available for download on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and more. Please support Indoctrination at patreon.com/indoctrination. Subscribers receive bonus episodes, interviews, and other cool goodies. Send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. Thank you for your support.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.